I'm Robin Young. It's here and now, and it's caucus day in Iowa, that oddly American ritual that launches the 2008 presidential campaign. Republicans will take a straw poll. Democrats will move about a caucus room in a combination square dance math exam using a formula to pick the convention delegates that will represent the top candidates. It's predicted a record number of Iowans will turn out, but the temperature is in single digits and the Orange Bowl is on TV, so get out the vote efforts are imperative. And this year, a large number of Iowans are independents, undecided, or first-timers, so the race is wide open. For what it's worth, the latest poll released this morning by Reuters shows Democrat Barack Obama surging 4 points ahead of John Edwards, with Hillary Clinton slipping to third. Among Republicans, Mike Huckabee's lead over Mitt Romney grew 6 points, with Fred Thompson coming in third. Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa, joins us again on the line from Des Moines. And Kay, first of all, what are those polls worth? I mean, they've been so flexible. Are they really worth anything at this point?
They're worth the paper they're printed on or the internet that you've been seeing it on. They really are an interesting snapshot because, of course, we don't know exactly who will be showing up at these caucuses. In the past, there's not been a history of people turning out for the caucuses who have never done so before, but the campaigns of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side have been targeting those first-time caucus-goers, hoping to turn them out. We'll see if that comes to fruition
tonight. And you've been talking to the candidates. Barack Obama gave you a call at 7:23 a.m., according to your blog. What did he have to say?
Well, what he said was a little hoarse. Mm-hmm. He's lost his voice. He paid homage to Iowans. He talked about the process and, of course, expressed optimism. I've talked now to, I believe, five candidates, and each of them expressing optimism heading into tonight.
John Edwards expressing that same optimism at 8:18 this morning. He's been doing this marathon, 36.
Exactly.
I mean, has he slept at all?
I didn't ask. I should have, shouldn't I?
Yeah, well, he's been going straight through. But you also heard from Mitt Romney. What did he say?
He expressed optimism, but he did bring up an interesting point, which I thought was fascinating. He brought up the weather and suggesting that senior citizens might find it too cold to caucus tonight. That, of course, enters into the calculation. Iowa has a population that tends to be older than the nation in general. And so if older folks don't turn out, turnout could be depressed by that.
But did he also bring up Mike Huckabee? Last night on Jay Leno.
I did.
Let's remind people, on Jay Leno and today on Don Imus, Mike Huckabee was asked if there was genuine hate between he and Romney. And on Imus, he said, well, it's not just me, meaning, I guess, that doesn't like Romney. He says, as I said on Leno last night, I remind people of someone they work with. Romney reminds them of someone who laid them off. What did Romney say today about Huckabee?
Well, actually, what Romney said was something in regards to a Huckabee allegation in the closing hours. The Huckabee camp is accusing Romney and his campaign of sending out mailers to Huckabee supporters telling them the wrong place to go tonight. Governor Romney denied that and accused Mr. Huckabee of a little whining. He used a different word, but yes, there's no love lost between these two campaigns and between these two candidates at this point. They're in a neck-and-neck battle here. Winning first place means a lot to both of them. To Romney, it's a nice propel into New Hampshire. For Huckabee, it's a validation of a campaign that, a few weeks ago, nobody thought was going anywhere. So they both need a victory here tonight, and, the animosity between them is just sure to rise in that kind of an atmosphere.
Well, it's funny you mentioned, in today's Wall Street Journal, Iowa journalist Michael Judge asks the question, is all this hoopla really justified because the last time Iowans picked a president, it was Jimmy Carter? I mean, but apparently—
Actually, they didn't pick Jimmy Carter.
Huh?
The top place finisher in 1976 was undecided. There were more people who could not settle on a candidate among the Democratic caucus goers in 1976. Jimmy Carter finished second to a gentleman or female known as undecided.
Well, and so, just in the couple seconds we have, obviously candidates, are thinking it doesn't matter. They want to win.
A win is a win. It's a good thing to have. Third place is not a terribly good thing to have, even if you're a Fred Thompson on the Republican side, and particularly if you're a Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side.
Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa, speaking to us from Des Moines. Kay, thanks as always.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, you may recall Marshalltown, Iowa. That's a town of about 30,000 halfway between Des Moines and Cedar Rapids. Just over a year ago, immigration officers raided the Swift meat packing plant there. About 100 suspected illegal immigrants were arrested. Many were deported. During the past 2 years, we've touched down in Marshalltown to talk about immigration and other issues, and we want to check in again today. So to start, we welcome back Martha Garcia. She's a real estate agent with Five Star Real Estate. Martha, do I understand you became a U.S. citizen in 2005 after living in the U.S. legally for nearly 20 years?
Yes, that's correct.
And so this is your first caucus, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm so excited.
I bet you are. What other feelings do you have going into the caucus tonight?
Well, I feel so proud to be in America now and to be a citizen, and we need to participate, and our votes count.
What are the issues that are important to you? What do you want to hear the candidates talk about?
First, what they can do in the war. We want the war stop it. For me, I think it is wasting time and life because my son wants to be a police officer or be in the Marines.
So the Iraq War is very important to you. What else?
Yes. The next point is immigration. Immigration, I don't want the people feel like I feel before, like you need to be a ghost in order to be living in the United States because you are not regulation in here.
You felt like you needed to be a ghost. Tell us more about that, especially after the raid at the meatpacking plant. How has that impacted you or the people that you interact with?
I talking about immigration and I start shaking because that one was a really bad experience. And that day I cry. If you see the faces and the kids' faces, and I remember when I was a ghost, it's like nobody knows what you're doing.
We've been reading reports of people who, you know, huddling in the home and not answering the door or not answering their phone, immigrants in Marshalltown, because they're afraid that it might be another raid.
Oh, yeah.
But how did it affect your business?
Oh, really bad. Let me tell you, when I began in 2001, I saw more houses. And that year, when I don't work completely the whole year, I sold more houses than this year.
Well, we know you work largely with the Hispanic population. Have people been leaving, or are they just not buying homes because, you know, they're not feeling secure?
No. Actually, it's people who are residents. They are leaving because they feel like everybody is mistreating them. The thing when I look at, I don't want an amnesty. I don't want nothing free for the people who don't deserve it. Like people who are working and they don't have any trouble with the law. They are breaking the law because they are illegal. But they are working. They are paying taxes. That people have an opportunity to have a work permit for 5, 10 years.
Well, what candidates are giving you some answers?
Senator Clinton and Obama.
And, you know, but I wonder, though, you know, Senator Clinton was really criticized for first siding with New York's plan to license illegal immigrants so that at least there'd be some safety on the roads, and then saying that she didn't agree with that. You know, have you been disappointed in her? Or do you think she's saying things?
Yes. And another thing what I'm disappointed with Senator Clinton is she wants to continue to do the wall. We're fighting a lot for the wall in Russia and in many places coming down, and now we are building one.
Oh, so Martha, you're saying that Clinton backs the wall along the border with Mexico, and we as a country have fought to have walls taken down in other places like
yes.
Germany. So who are you, whose corner are you thinking of standing in tonight at the Democratic caucus?
Well, I'm not this idea. They need to give me a little bit more information, and I want to see the reaction of the people.
Wow, the day of, and you're still undecided.
Well, I need to listen. What the people, probably they hear better things than me.
So, Martha, the caucus process itself, other people, other Democrats getting together and talking in the caucus room is going to be part of your decision-making. Well,
yes.
Martha Garcia, a real estate agent in Marshalltown, Iowa, participating in her first Iowa caucus tonight. Martha, best to you.
Thank you so much.
Well, we want to turn now to Lon Walker. He's the police chief in Marshalltown. Lon, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you today.
What are the issues involving immigration for you?
Well, the issues for me with the police department are just huge. We don't enforce immigration law. We don't have that authority that rests solely with federal immigration agents at this point in time. But the spin-off effect has been very huge for us. In 2007, we had over 100 cases of identity theft that we had to investigate.
Well, what's your sense of what the candidates have been saying about immigration? Who's resonating for you and who's not?
I like what I hear from a number of different candidates, but I don't like the total package that I hear from any of them. I think that Senator McCain's package probably makes the most sense, in that I think that he is probably the only candidate right now who would be willing to reach across that political aisle and try to truly solve the problem. You know, some of them are taking a real hardline approach, for example, like Governor Romney.
Well, you mentioned former Governor Romney. I'm thinking of former Governor Huckabee as well. But here you are, somebody who's on the front line, who really has day-to-day interaction. You know, what did you think when, for instance, Mike Huckabee, who as governor was very supportive of educating children of illegal immigrants, and now talks about sending everyone home?
Well, I think that's problematic for me, and that's probably one reason that Governor Huckabee is not somebody that I will probably caucus for this evening. And I agree with Martha that I don't think amnesty is the answer. But on the other hand, there is a need for workers.
So you're not one of those saying ship everybody back across the border?
No, of course not.
Well, Lon Walker, I just want to, before we let you go, ask what other issues are on your mind going into tonight's Republican straw vote?
Well, immigration is not my top issue personally going into the caucuses tonight. I'm very concerned about the future of this country when it comes to national security, terrorism, the use of the military. And I think that the next president has to have a firm grasp on how the military operates, what you can use the military for and what you can't.
You're a veteran of Desert Storm. Do you think the next president has to be a veteran?
Well, I would prefer the next president be a veteran, and there's only two candidates, I think, that are actually veterans. But I think that someone who is a governor or a senator doesn't have the military background and experience to understand those issues.
Well, Lon Walker, I would only ask this of someone in Iowa or New Hampshire or one of these early states, because I know it's possible. Have you gotten to talk to what sounds like your guy, you know, John McCain, on any of these issues?
I have.
Huh.
I was able to sit down with Senator McCain several months ago one-on-one, and I'd read his book, Why Courage Matters, and actually that's what we talked a little bit about. I have a son in high school who's contemplating going to the military academy for college, and we talked a little bit about that, and I told him that after reading his book, having discussions with my son about why courage matters was just huge, and I have a great deal of respect for the senator.
How much does that matter? I mean, what was that like to sit there with someone you might vote for? How much does that matter in your decision tonight when you go into that caucus room?
To me, it matters a great deal that a United States senator running for the presidency would take the time to sit down with a small town police chief. You know, I'm inconsequential in those kind of matters. And I was just very appreciative of the fact that, you know, he would take 15 minutes to sit down and talk one-on-one with me.
Lon Walker is police chief of Marshalltown, Iowa. Chief Walker, thanks so much, and best to you tonight at the caucus.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It is caucus day, and when we come back, we're going to hear more about illegal immigration. It is a central concern to many Iowans, not just in Marshalltown, as we'll hear. Back in a minute, here and now. It's caucus day in Iowa. We just spoke with two Iowans heading to rooms in local hotels and high schools tonight to caucus for their candidates. And as we heard from them, one of the issues of concern, at least in Marshalltown, Iowa, is immigration reform. Well, joining us with more on that is Jonathan Weissman of The Washington Post. Jonathan, how would you characterize the role immigration has played in this campaign?
Well, on the Republican side, it has been the organizing issue. What I mean is, it has been the dominant issue on debates, and it has been the way that Republicans with somewhat suspect conservative credentials like Mitt Romney have showed that they're the tough guys. It has been the way for Mitt Romney and for Mike Huckabee to shore up their credentials and look like they are indeed the real conservative standard bearers.
Well, give us an example of the imagery that's been filling mailboxes, for instance.
There have been flyers just stuffing the mailboxes in New Hampshire and Iowa. Images like a Ron Paul flyer that had a Statue of Liberty with an illegal alien's doormat at its foot, mm-hmm. or a Stars and Stripes fluttering with a Mexican flag above it. Mitt Romney sent out a mailer that looked like a U.S. passport on the outside. and then it said only one candidate will really stamp out illegal immigration, and you turn it in, and it's kind of a dossier, a hit dossier of all the other Republican candidates and why they aren't going to really take a tough stand on illegal immigration.
Well, we just heard from a Republican police chief in Marshalltown, Iowa, who said he didn't like that kind of language or the language of throw the bums out. Is he alone?
He's not alone at all, but there is a very strong population of conservative Republicans who really, you can't go too far on this issue. They are very anti-illegal immigration. Some would say they're anti-immigration, period, and they are looking for the toughest rhetoric at all. Now, the problem with Republicans is that as they fight for that vote, they risk alienating people like your Marshalltown sheriff. Or in the general election, I mean, there's a very large mass of Latino voters who are really, really upset about the tone of this debate.
Well, during the debates, the Republican debates, Rudy Giuliani accused Mitt Romney of having illegal workers at his home here in Massachusetts. Mitt Romney turned around and pointed out that Giuliani had run a sanctuary city as mayor of New York and welcomed illegal immigrant workers. Romney also accused Mike Huckabee of supporting financial aid for illegal students when Huckabee was governor of Arkansas. Huckabee responding, you know, our country is better than that. We don't punish children. But since those exchanges, it seems as if the candidates have pretty much all sounded the same on immigration.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because Giuliani, interestingly, is running as the law and order candidate, and it's really put him on the defensive when he has Mitt Romney running ads and really attacking him for what he says being light on illegal aliens, that is, lawbreakers. And in the Huckabee instance, he gave this passionate response about the humanity of the children of illegal immigrants, and then just days later accepted the endorsement of Mr. Gilchrist, who was the founder of the Minutemen, kind of the vigilante group on the border, and then unveiled his own border security initiative, which was extremely punitive, and rejected something called the Dream Act, which would have allowed the children of illegal immigrants to become citizens if they finished high school, attended 2 years of college, or joined the military.
Don't people notice that? A flip-flop like that?
Well, I think that they will in the general election. Now, right now, I think that there's a real kind of blind spot on this illegal immigration issue. You know, I talked to Peter Hart, who's a Democratic pollster. He said he's never seen passion around an issue like this since busing, because it's an issue that affects people all over the country in very tangible ways.
Well, but in New Hampshire, which holds its primary Tuesday, there isn't a significant immigrant population. So why that
passion?
But that's
actually, that's what's interesting, because where it is most kind of volatile is not the border states that have been obviously living with an immigrant Mexican population for you know, hundreds of years. It is in areas like Iowa and New Hampshire that have pockets of illegal immigrants and legal immigrants for really the first time in decades.
These are some of the first Spanish-speaking people in Iowa have ever met.
Absolutely. I mean, New Hampshire is a state of 1.3 million people. Its Hispanic population is 2.3%. But that 2.3% is relatively very new.
Let me ask you, Jonathan, on the other hand, we've been speaking of Republicans. Do Democrats risk losing the votes of Americans who are generally concerned about this, well, biggest influx of immigrants in America's history?
This is a real difficult dance for Democrats because, remember, they want to be the party of these Latino voters. They are hoping that Latino voters could actually swing states their way that have been reliably Republican in presidential elections. But they also have a lot of working class Democrats, what we used to call Reagan Democrats, who feel like that this influx of immigrants are lowering wages and taking jobs and keeping them down. So Democrats can't look like they're too light on illegal immigration, but they really risk not being able to capitalize on the anger in the Latino population if they, too, are seen as one Latino activist told me, making them radioactive, just like the Republicans are.
Jonathan Weissman, one last question. John McCain, his support of immigration reform almost capsized his campaign early on. He's now changed his stance to be more in line with the hardliners. He says, for instance, only when the border is certified as closed will he consider the path to citizenship for illegal immigrants. He's become tougher. And he's also seen a surge. Is that because he refined his original thoughts and got tougher, or because he stuck to his basic premise of a pathway to citizenship?
I think it's more because he is the candidate of last resort. I think that a lot of Republicans are looking at Mike Huckabee and having second thoughts. They're looking at Mitt Romney and having second thoughts. And Giuliani's campaign is really, really in trouble, and people are moving back to McCain. I don't think he will be forgiven by the real hardcore anti-illegal immigration crowd out there. I just think that people are beginning to look beyond this issue when they're now thinking, well, who really is going to be the Republican nominee?
Jonathan Weissman of The Washington Post. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, of course, we'll analyze Iowa. Also, under a new agreement with Pakistan, U.S. Special Forces will be able to operate freely there. What does that mean for U.S.-Pakistan relations? That's all tomorrow. Still ahead, author Edward Bell shakes his family tree to come up with DNA trails. That's after the news here and now. According to a recent poll by the Los Angeles Times and Bloomberg News, about 70% of Americans want the U.S. out of Iraq right away, or at least by the end of 2008. Well, you might expect such strong opinion to be reflected on college campuses, traditionally hotbeds of social activism. Why haven't more schools mobilized against the war? Well, Here Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff took a look at some New England schools to explain why.
At an anti-war protest in Maine, Tristan Brosnan stood behind a small table on the edge of a field. As opposition activist Cindy Sheehan spoke to a crowd of about 500, Brosnan tried to sign up new members for the Campus Anti-War Network.
So have you personally done any anti-war activity?
Since the first war in Iraq.
Okay.
Since the Gulf War, yeah.
The Campus Anti-War Network started in 2003, just before the U.S. invaded Iraq. It's a national organization based in Wisconsin, but only has 25 chapters, three in Massachusetts. But Brosnan, who's a sophomore at UMass Amherst, says that's not because students are apathetic.
They don't feel like what they do makes a difference. I feel like if people said, hey, I could go out to this one demonstration and end the war, that everyone would be out in the streets in a second. The reality is one demonstration will never end the war, and it takes a movement to actually do that. And I think it's our job to convince people and provide political answers to how we can actually end the war, and what we do does make a difference.
The lack of student activism on campuses is alarming some professors, students, and alumni. Boston University students created a new group this semester called Bring BU Back. Its goal is to increase campus activism around a host of issues. Andrew Basevich, who teaches international relations and history at BU, is a vocal critic of the war. He says his students are not shallow or frivolous, but it's hard to explain why they aren't more engaged.
They're concerned about the war. You know, they're concerned about another 9/11. But that concern doesn't really translate into a sense of personal obligation to go do something, whether in support of the war or against the war.
Basevich, who served in Vietnam, says he thinks the issue comes down to the draft. Military service is a matter of choice, and unless that changes, he believes there won't be a growing student anti-war movement.
Were there to be a draft, I don't think it's politically feasible, were there magically to be a draft, my prediction would be that overnight we would have an anti-war movement that would be at least as large and as energetic as we saw during the Vietnam War.
Before the Iraq War started, Harvard University was host to the largest protest in Harvard Yard since Vietnam. But since then, while students have protested genocide in Darfur and janitors' wages, activism around the war has subsided. Recently, a group of Harvard alum from the class of 1967 wrote to the university president that they're concerned about the, quote, widespread apathy and political indifference on campus. That may be because the war doesn't feel immediate to students, says Timothy McCarthy, a Harvard expert in social movements.
The kids that I teach, none of them have a sense of urgency about their connection to the war. Many of them don't even know anyone who's fighting in the war. And there isn't the radical sense of urgency that, oh my God, any day now I can get plucked out of my class and not have to worry about my papers because I'm going to be shipped off to Fallujah.
Another impediment to a student anti-war movement could be the 2008 presidential race. Christopher Doles, a national leader with the Campus Anti-War Network, says the elections have slowed down participation.
Similar to what we saw in 2004, election years tend to have the following impact on social movements. People think, well, at the very least, we can expect a lesser evil, and therefore, we should put our independent movement on hold while we get this lesser evil elected.
Doles, who's a senior at the University of Wisconsin, says that thinking is wrong because none of the candidates can be trusted to end the war. The student group's next large anti-war demonstration isn't scheduled until mid-March. That will mark the fifth anniversary of the war in Iraq, which has now gone on longer than U.S. involvement in World War II.
Here now is Monica Brady-Meyerhoff. And as Monica mentioned, about a dozen Harvard graduates wrote a letter to Harvard President Drew Gilpin Faust asking her to create a task force on student apathy. Well, one of the signatories was Arlene Ashe, a research professor at Boston University's School of Medicine. And Arlene, first of all, what does an administration have to do with college students' apathy? Activism is supposed to come from the bottom up, not the top down.
Well, Harvard views itself as more than a trade school. It takes seriously its responsibility to direct students. It said this explicitly when it was developing its core curriculum. And I think it should expand its sense of what it means to graduate educated men and women. It should graduate good citizens.
How would a school do that?
Well, you could have a requirement like the core curriculum of some evidence of active citizenship. I could imagine that you could fulfill this requirement of active citizenship by researching some particular hot issue of the day, coming to an informed opinion, and going to speak to a legislator about it.
You went to school in 67, powerful years. Is that part of, why you have this thinking? Because you did go to school in a year when there was so much activism? And I ask because, and those of us who were around in those years remember that, not everybody in the late 60s was involved in activism.
Actually, we might have been the last class that wasn't so active. We graduated in 67, and campuses really erupted in 68. When I was an undergraduate, women weren't allowed to set foot in the undergraduate library, and we didn't know enough to protest that.
So you're saying it's not that you're encouraging activism now because you were an activist in the 60s, but almost because you weren't, because there's opportunity now, so why not?
Maybe because I just feel desperately that our country has taken so many wrong steps, and I really want to reach back and try to encourage my school to do a better job.
The letter that you signed notes that Harvard is the best endowed institution of higher learning in the world with a reported net worth of $36 billion. And we were wondering, because there's more recent news, the college world, as you know, is buzzing with reports that Harvard is going to provide more aid for upper middle-income families, eliminate loans and debt. And that's launched a debate about whether giving kids of moderate income families, essentially someone called it a free ride, is going to make these kids at Harvard even less engaged. But what do you think about that move? Is that going to help or hinder in your goal?
Well, lots of people who stand back from protesting say that the reason is they have all these college debts to pay. So my experience, in fact, is that people who come from very difficult financial situations, their families have struggled to send them to school. These are the people who are under the greatest obligation to take well-paid careers and to go that route. For many of us, it was like the second generation that grew up comfortable that was able to say, I don't need to make money. My relatives are okay. I don't have a big debt. Maybe I can do something more that gives back.
That's Arlene Ashe of the Harvard class of 1967 and one of the signatories to a letter expressing concern about apathy on campus. Arlene, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And tomorrow, something people are passionate about, the princess craze, including the new Disney line of wedding dresses. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. College football's never-ending bowl season continues tonight with the Orange Bowl game between Kansas and Virginia Tech. We mentioned at the beginning of the program concern that it might keep Iowans at home tonight on caucus night, but based on the bowl games so far, not to worry, because after one of the most exciting regular seasons in recent memory, fans are saying the bowls have been mismatches. Last night, West Virginia scored a 48-28 romp over Oklahoma in the Fiesta Bowl. The Rose Bowl, Sugar Bowl, Cotton Bowl, all decided by margins of at least 31 points. Here to talk about that and the rest of the world of sport, Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield. Bill, Happy New Year to you.
Robin, Happy New Year to you.
And we greet it with these games. Why are they so lopsided?
Well, I'm sure there are numbers of reasons. One of the games that I paid most attention to was not lopsided. Florida State University lost to Kentucky 38-25 or something like that, so not too bad. And the reason that happened was Florida State had half its team suspended for cheating. I think they cheated on a music appreciation exam, and there was a certain irony to the fact that they weren't allowed to go to the Music City Bowl as a result.
There's that. Well, and you know, some are saying that there's just not a real playoff system for big-time college football. Do you agree?
Well, there isn't a playoff system, and most people who follow college football closely believe that there should be a playoff system. I don't. I'm very happy with the current system because I think the more large groups of students who can confidently shout, "We're number one," the better. It makes people feel good.
Yes.
Don't you think?
And we're about that. Well, yeah. The pros, though, have a real playoff system. It kicks off this weekend with wild card games. I'll run through them. The NFC, Washington plays Seattle. The New York Giants play Tampa Bay. In the AFC, Jacksonville meets Pittsburgh. Tennessee against San Diego. Anything jump out at you when we start here?
Well, I'm curious about how some of these games are going to go. The Giants looked terrific against the Patriots last week.
They shouldn't have even been
in the same park, and they only lost by 3 points, and they scored a touchdown late in the game. They never quit, even though they lost a lead that they had previously had. They look good, and so it'll be interesting to see whether they continue to look good. Pittsburgh, on the other hand, looked awful in their final regular season game, but they were resting most of the guys who have made them look as good as they have looked for most of the season. So it'll be interesting to see whether those guys can come back and play well, having sat out a week, or well enough at least to get back past Jacksonville.
And you mentioned our New England Patriots. They're going to sit out this weekend after that slim win, over the Giants. Do you see a team? I mean, you know, some are now saying the Giants, you know, they can knock them off.
Well, any number of teams can knock them off. Of course, the operating principle in pro football is that players get hurt, and they get hurt a lot, and they get hurt badly enough so that they can't come back and play anymore. And so any team is vulnerable, obviously, on any given week. The Patriots have to be favored, no matter who they're playing in the playoffs. I would think the Colts might give them a tough time, but the Steelers might. Any number of teams.
And the Giants did have some injuries after that valiant effort the other night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we want to just mention Roger Clemens scheduled to appear on 60 Minutes Sunday night. This is part of his campaign to clear his name after he was accused of using steroids and human growth hormone in the Mitchell Report. He's already denied that he used performance-enhancing drugs. Why is he, you know, your thoughts about his doing this interview?
Well, maybe he's counting on Mike Wallace being a Yankees fan and more particularly a Roger Clemens fan. Wallace is apparently on the record as being a fan. But I don't think that that's going to alter the trajectory of the interview. I would think Clemens might be a little bit worried by the fact that his former trainer is represented by an attorney who says that if Clemens says in that interview that the trainer is lying, a lawsuit will follow in short order. And I don't care how much money you have stashed away. It's no fun being sued, and that's the kind of thing that could have a real impact on how Clemens is thought of and what sort of legacy he leaves behind.
And you know that the question that he's going to be asked on 60 Minutes is your trainer lying?
Oh, I would think so. And of course, this is he is in a position where he can't really do the old excuse me, the old congressional dance, which is, I don't want to talk about the past.
Right. Because he's there to talk about
the past. He's there
to
talk about a particular, allegation.
Right. Well, people will be tuning into that and tuning into Bill's Only a Game every weekend on NPR. Do not miss it. Bill Littlefield, host of Only a Game. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And just 1 minute, author Edward Ball on testing ancestors' DNA to see if he's related to the slaves that they owned. That's in 1 minute, here and now. It began with a collection of hair found in a 200-year-old desk. Actually, it began before that. It began with author Edward Ball's search for the descendants of the slaves who worked on his ancestors' South Carolina rice plantations. He won a National Book Award in 1998 for Slaves in the Family. Then he organized a huge reunion of sorts with members of his white family and descendants of the slaves. And that would have been that. But then he bought the old desk, which had been in the home of a relative, and found samples of his ancestors' hair. He decided to subject those samples to the most modern and celebrated of techniques, DNA analysis.
It's the key to crime stories, unlocking the ending and naming the villain. It's the master code of medicine, promising to heal if the codebreakers can decrypt it. It's the voice of evolution, revealing events of 100,000 years ago before humans walked out of Africa to people the rest of the world. Not immune to the magic of DNA, I had expectations of the hair collection. Would the genetic data in the hair tell new family stories or spill old medical secrets?
Or, as Edward Ball writes in the preface to his new book, would all that testing leave more questions than he began with? The book is called The Genetic Strand, Exploring a Family History Through DNA, and Ed Ball joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, listeners may remember your story because it was featured on Scott Simon's Weekend Edition. And full disclosure, I also reported on your family story. We went to your family reunion together.
That's right. Yeah. Some years ago, and you were doing it for ABC.
That's right. But remind those who haven't heard your family history. What is it?
My father's family in South Carolina were slaveholders and plantation owners for 200 years. And a few years ago, I decided I would try to tell that story, but also to try to find black families whose ancestors we had once enslaved, and with their permission to tell their family stories, too.
And then the reunion was also interesting. I mean, a lot of people didn't want to know about the slaves in the family.
That's true. It was a taboo subject, even in my generation, because no one knew what would happen if we opened that box.
And speaking of opening that box, you open another one. This is a hidden drawer in this secretary. Everybody can picture, you know, there's an old desk.
It's about the size of a refrigerator. It's 7 feet tall and 4 feet wide. It has a flip-down writing surface.
And tell us more about what you found in that little drawer.
I found a collection of human hair clipped from the heads of children, of old people, of cousins, all in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, and these were all relatives of mine. It was very creepy, in fact.
Yeah. Well, first of all, who were some of these relatives? Just rattle off a couple of
characters. Great-great-grandparents. There was a guy named William James Ball who was age 3 when his parents cut the lock of his hair, and he grew up to be owner of 9 plantations, and then his son, a guy named Isaac Ball, known as Isaac the Confederate in the family because he, at age 18, marched off to join the South Carolina Infantry, and a number of other people.
Why was it creepy for you, the hair?
Because it was like finding a crypt. I knew all these people and what their lives had been like, and they were all long dead. But, you know, when you touched some of this hair, which was as smooth and silky as the day it had been cut from a child's head, it was like having a bit of their person.
Yeah. And touching it in, you know, this century meant that you were going to learn something
right,
about them.
Right, yes. Well, it occurred to me after I got over the creep factor that archaeologists had dug up Neanderthal bones and extracted DNA from them. I thought this hair might also have DNA. And it might be a way for me to learn about DNA science, which is now the queen discipline of the hard sciences.
Was that it? Or did you want to learn about science? Or did you even early on want to learn about yourself?
A bit of both. I had, like everyone, this idea that DNA was this kind of religious truth, and it might have some sort of secret that no other document or historical account could have.
in particular in this family, given that it was a family that lived on plantations with African Americans. And you write that the one thing you knew about yourself was that you were thoroughly white.
Pure white, yes. This family, as many Southern families and perhaps other regions too, took great pride in its English roots. For us, whiteness was something like a kind of purity. It meant you had no Jews in the family, you had no Italians, you had no African Americans or Native Americans, you probably had no Catholics.
Now, let's take listeners on some of your journey, because the testing starts and you get news that you write is a crack in your windshield, or rather your rearview mirror, because you're looking back through DNA, that you might have Native American ancestry?
That's right. This child, William James Ball, according to a lab in California called Trace Genetics, his mother possibly had Native American genes. And this was a shock. And there was no family tradition that might explain this.
And you start talking to cousins. And what starts to happen among this generation of Balls?
I had a photograph of a great grandmother named Kate Fuller. It was whispered in the family that she was a mulatta. And you know, this is, of course, a word that nobody uses now. A woman of mixed race. So I thought, well, how can I figure this out? I didn't have any hair belonging to Kate Fuller, but I had a cousin who was a maternal descendant of Kate Fuller, and I asked if I could test her DNA to see whether there was any sign that she might have had African genes. And what happened was Catherine, this cousin, her tests came back and said, "Dear Mr. Ball, I'm pleased to say that you are affiliated with the Serer people of Senegal." And this was a second shock, because not only did we have no family tradition, but there was a taboo about white and black interracial sex in the plantation period, and certainly we'd inherited that taboo.
Were you afraid that you might find a big secret in the family, possibly having to do with intermingling with the slaves, or were you sort of hoping for it?
I'm a bit more of a troublemaker than that. I was kind of hoping for it. In fact, when I got these results that we might have Native American genes and that we'd had West African genes, I thought, oh, wow, now I can really cause some trouble.
Aunt so-and-so is rolling in her grave right now. But did that test stand, the Senegal?
The Senegal test was contradicted later by a different test. I found a geneticist in Cambridge, England, named Peter Forster, who said, well, in fact, these markers are not necessarily West African markers. They might be from Central Europe.
So now you and your relatives are like, we're all white. No, wait, we're black. But wait, we're not. It becomes very confusing.
It's a seesaw, in fact, yeah. And there's an ambiguity that was very confusing and disorienting, and but fascinating nevertheless.
Did you ever think of not writing the book? Did you ever think, you know, 8/9 of the way through when it was like, oh, geez, you're kidding. That was true. Now it's not true. I don't have this big slam bang ending that, you know, there was this big awful secret in my family.
Yeah, I thought about that, but I thought that the conclusion, which is that science has an unequaled role in the society, that almost replacing that of the churches, that conclusion that we treat scientists with too much reverence was an important one. And I read seriously in the literature of genetics for 2 years in the peer review journals, and none of the people that I read ever admitted making a mistake. So I believe that there should be a little bit more ambiguity that's disclosed in the game of genetics.
Edward Ball's new book is The Genetic Strand, Exploring a Family History Through DNA. He's been speaking to us in the studio. Edward, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.